Welcome to the Sons of Mjolnir podcast.
The Sons of... what?
This isn't your Sons of Macaroni, yeah!
The Sons of Mjolnir?
This is Sons of Mjolnir, yeah!
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Sons of Mjolnir. As always, I am one of your hosts, Fat Thor. And today I am joined by a very special guest. You may know him as the writer of books such as The Game, The Adept, and How I Slept My Way Through College and Other Tales from Freshman Year. And probably most notably, the books of White Ash and then now its spinoff, Galarian, which the first issue was actually one of the most backed Kickstarter issues ever. I am joined today by Charlie Stickney. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on and nerding out with me today. I'm super excited to have you.
Well, I'm really excited to be here. I love the concept for this show. I think it's really much in the theme of some of the things I'm building in White Ash. So I'm excited to sort of add to what you're already doing.
Beautiful. And like I said, we're so happy to have you. We were lucky enough to read some of Galarian that you sent us for this interview. And it's one of those things, like, I'm almost embarrassed to say that I'm just now jumping on because I really, really enjoyed it. I'm a huge, mythology, obviously, as Fat Thor, mythology nerd and, you know, fantasy and all that stuff. And I just really love the world that you've created here with White Ash and Galarian. So I am just super excited to get all into the nitty gritty nerdy stuff with you today.
Well, thanks. I mean, I think that's one of the hardest things for independent comics. Even when they're coming out from larger publishers and, White Ash came out for a while through Scout Comics. Mm-hmm. Before that, it was on Kickstarter. And now we've kind of gone back to Kickstarter. It's finding that audience and building upon it. And where I am really fortunate is that over time, we have continually been able to grow that audience. Mm-hmm. To the point where, yes, I mean, like, it, in terms of like single issue series on Kickstarter, Galarian is one of the biggest that comes out on a regular basis, and White Ash is right up there too. So we have a huge following on Kickstarter where we're a top 10 brand. Eventually we'll be moving that back into the direct market, and maybe down the road, we'll see. These things are, there may be other forms of White Ash and Galarian coming out in other media. So
well, I'm excited for all of it. Like I said, now that I'm in the world, you fully grabbed me, my friend. I am fully in the world of White Ash. So wherever it's coming out from, publisher or, Kickstarter, I am fully on board. But before we get into all the great stuff about Galarian and the world that you've created, I kind of want to start off and take a step back a little bit and talk a little bit about your origin story, if you would. So something we typically do on the show is kind of talk about people's comic origin, how they got into the media. And yours was very interesting to me just because I felt like I related to it very, very much. You talk about that as a kid, you were a very avid collector of Marvel books specifically.
Yeah.
And everyone who watches or listens to our show knows that we joke around that we're the Marvel boys and all that. And you also talked about getting into Batman stories, and that was another thing that really grabbed you, which again, that was another thing that really grabbed me. So I guess my question on top of all that, you're collecting Marvel, the Batman's really getting into you. Do you remember some of maybe the specific storylines and or maybe issues that really started that collective bug, if you would?
Sure, sure. And, I'm a child that grew up in the 80s, born in slightly before the 80s. But, Transformers were kind of my gateway drug back to comics. Mm. I always had a few issues just lying around in a box on the floor, but I was collecting Transformers. I picked up a 3-pack of Transformer comic books, and in it I saw Spider-Man was in the black costume when he was battling Megatron in like the second issue, which was crazy, a weird crossover anyway. I don't know really what they were trying to do there, but it worked.
Comics, baby.
Yeah, yeah. And so like I had to find out why he was in that black costume. So I went to the bookstore and I picked up Amazing Spider-Man 287, which was the middle of this gang war series that was happening. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting, and Daredevil standing over him with his billy club saying like, "Stay down, Spider-Man." I was like, "Who is this Daredevil? What's going on?" And I quickly got hooked in because honestly, like on the heels of that was one of the best little runs of Spider-Man in the late 80s, early 90s, which was the Kraven the Hunter, Death in the Family, Kraven's Last Hunt storyline.
Such a great story.
Like,
such
so
a great
basically
line.
Like within like 5 months of me collecting comics, that dropped, and you know, it was kind of terrifying and horrifying, and then that followed up with like another little mini crossover where Spider-Man was in an insane asylum. It was like the Mad Dog something or other. Mm-hmm. And you know, so then I was like picking up some Spectacular Spider-Man and Web, and I was getting really immersed into the world. And then this young artist who was trying to do some crazy things with webs, Todd McFarlane, took over the book.
I think I've heard of him before.
Yeah. And then they introduced this character Venom. And so like that was like my formative time getting into comics. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, well, what is this Todd McFarlane? What else has he done? Oh, he did this run on the Incredible Hulk. So I picked that up, and then I got into the Incredible Hulk. And then there was a crossover with the X-Men. So like, and then like, you know, a year later, I was getting 50 titles a month.
Yeah, so, just snowballed and snowballed.
So quickly. But it was also a great time because you had Chris Claremont at the height of his game. Mm-hmm. You had Peter David taking over his run on the Incredible Hulk. You had all that amazing stuff going on with Spider-Man, and you had the artist revolution. And then you had like Todd McFarlane, and then you had Jim Lee coming, you know, like, and so it was a really exciting time in comics. I loved that whole space, and I loved being part of it, and I loved going to conventions. I remember one of my first conventions I went to was at the Something Cloud Inn in Dover, New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And I'm walking through there, and this creator behind a table was like, "Hey, John, Charlie," I was there with my friend John, and I'm like, "How does he know who we are?" And he's like, "Guys, you got name tags." I was like, "Oh yeah," and he's like, "Come on. Come check out my comic, The Tick." And it was Ben Udland, and he had like 3 issues of The Tick done. So like getting into that, like right at the time when that was just still a super indie comic, that opened my eyes that there was more than Marvel in DC. Mm-hmm. And there was also a presentation on the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles there. So I was kind of getting into the underground scene at that time. And then when I got to college, sometimes I think, at least for me, I was getting past the point where I wanted to read something that was curated IP. And by that, I mean, you know, someone is there as a steward to make sure that the character doesn't really change that much. But it does every couple of years when a new writer comes on. And so like the Spider-Man that I had fallen in love with, the Incredible Hulk that I'd fallen in love with, they weren't really quite feeling the same. Same thing with mm-hmm. the X-Men. There was a shift from Claremont to Scott Lobdell. And so like everything was shifting. And for me, that was at the time when Dark Horse was just sort of breaking. And, you know, until you had like Frank Miller with Sin City, you had Mike Mignola with Hellboy, and all these things were just starting. And so that was really interesting. And I kind of shifted over to collecting pretty much Dark Horse. Oh, and then like this obscure Vertigo line that was starting the series called Sandman. You know, like these man, crazy things. So
you're on
it
the ground floor of all the greats, man.
Yeah. So it was an interesting time, but it was also like my evolution going from, you know, the traditional superheroes and then sort of mm-hmm. giving some of that up to like the early wave of independent creators. I mean, Image was also launched that time, but I'll be honest, like I picked up a couple of those early issues of the Image books, but as a future writer, I was more interested in the writing of comics and especially the first 2 years of Image. If you go back, those books are not about the writing. Mm-hmm. They are about the art, and the art is brilliant. And it was, you know, artists cut loose in a way they hadn't been before. But like the characters weren't as fleshed out as they would be. You know, here we are 20 years later or 25 years later and Spawn's still going, you know, and like yeah. there's a rich tapestry for all of those characters now, but at the time there really wasn't. That pushed me into, you know, like the Dark Horse and the Vertigo for a while. So like I was doing that after college, and then you graduate from college and you reach this point where you're trying to figure out life. And when I was in college, it was a question of, do I go down into to be a comic book writer or an inker? I went to college in upstate New York. So it was like, do I move to New York City and do that? But I was also a film major and I got a job offer in LA for films. So it was like the two different paths. What do? I moved out to LA, you know, was a struggling artist for a long time. So comic books kind of had to go.
Yeah.
Just like food was more important at the time and the crazy
food,
LA
comics.
I know. And so I kind of dropped out of the comic scene for a while. And then things started taking off for me. And I worked in animation for a while. Mm-hmm. I've worked in feature film. I've worked in documentary. I've worked as a writer, a producer, an editor of a lot of different things. But, you know, in the, you know, mid-aughts to like 2010, the entertainment industry was also starting to change. Everything was becoming more based on IP. Iron Man had come out, and that was kind of changing, you know, the big blockbusters. And so they were cutting back on the kind of films I had come up wanting to make, mm-hmm. which were more like genre-based romantic comedies, like Groundhog Day, Serendipity, Click, you know, like those kind of fun things that they were doing back in the day, but they weren't making that kind of movie anymore. It was these huge blockbusters, or the interesting stuff was being done in television. And shifting to television just seemed like a crazy pivot for me, even though I had worked in animation. And I reached a sort of a tipping point where I was like, why am I killing myself to try to do these things when everyone keeps saying, we just want something that's based on a comic book. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I could just make comic books.
Yeah, cut off, you know, the middleman, like, of the equation.
It's been a long time, but like that was what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, around 2014, 2015, I started sort of putting plans into motion, and I was talking with my wife, and I was like, you know what? I mean, maybe we could look for a publishing deal. You know, I do have some credits as a writer, but I don't know, the publishing deals don't look great. How much money could we afford to invest and do it on our own? So we started like having these long conversations, and I was looking at the state of the industry, and independent comics are, and have always been, a labor of love. But if you're coming in as a newer creator, you have to really be careful. And I personally am lucky in that I've had a long time being on the other side, where, you know, I prepare budgets, and I've written contracts for animation and for, you know, film and things like that. So I know the things to look for. I know how accounting is done. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at the state of the industry, and this was, like I said, around 2015 at this point, 2016. And I was thinking, you know, what I want to do is I want to build this White Ash universe. And, you know, which they always tell you, don't, like, start small, get a series done. But I was like, you know, I want to do this thing that could be like a 60 issue series with spinoffs, or it could be a TV show that could run for 5 years, or it could be like, I wanted to build this big thing, because I mean, I had the experience of being a professional writer for years and years, and I had it planned and I had it plotted. But looking at traditional publishing, I was like, even if I landed a publishing deal, they're going to give me 4 issues. Even if you go to a place like Image, you know, and I was looking at the numbers, because back then the numbers were more readily available. You know, the number of creators who get past issue 6 in a series who don't have a name in comics is almost non-existent, mm-hmm. right? You know, and so to be able to get the retailers to buy in, to get to the numbers that it be enough so it would pay for the series, it just wasn't happening. And so I'm like, is this worth it? Is it worth jumping into this? And then, like, through all of those just conversations, I found Kickstarter, and it was still a little bit of the Wild West. And I was like, well, you know, if we do something here and it catches on. And at that time, people really weren't serializing books through Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. You know, it was mostly anthologies. It was trades. It was one shots, because people were looking at a project as you do this thing and then you kind of walk away. But there were like one or two books that were doing it. There was this one series, Skies of Fire, which is great, has beautiful art. I was like, oh, that looks like a great comic book. That looks like something that would stand up on the stands. I was like, okay, so people are doing it here. Let's try it. And, you know, the first issue of White Ash did well, you know, well for Kickstarter, especially for someone coming to it fresh. And we just kept building on there. And over, you know, since 2016, we built up a massive fan base. We built up a huge following over there. And yeah, you know, I found that it's just an amazing place to be able to connect with fans, to tell stories, to be able to raise enough money to hire the best artists, to work with some of the best in the industry, and pay them as much or as more than a lot of major publishers are paying. And we can do all that through Kickstarter and also own the rights and know that we can keep doing this. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, you've taken I've taken control of things in a way where I know if I want to, I can do this for another 10 years and keep telling these stories. So you can plot things out for things to drop in 3 years, 4 years, 5 years down the road. So, you know, I'm just very happy and very fortunate how everything has worked out for me in the comic space.
And I mean, yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, hearing your kind of relationship with comic books and how you kind of were, again, like I said, you know, you were on the ground floor for some of the, you know, legendary stories of comics. I mean, you know, with Spider-Man in the black suit and then Spawn and the Tick, like you were right there. And I think it was also interesting how you, like, your taste kind of went with the medium, right? Like you said, you know, you started getting in indies with Sandman, like, which, you know, everyone knows Sandman's probably one of the biggest indie books out there and one that really opened people's eyes to, like you were saying, there are really great books outside of the big two. So that's just super interesting to hear about. And I also wanted to ask you too, you touched on this a bit about working in film and TV and animation and stuff like that. What would you say, I guess, one, what is the biggest thing that you learned from that side of your career coming into comics? And also, what would you say is the biggest difference between writing a comic script as opposed, let's say TV, just to make it, you know, more structured, like an episode of TV versus an issue of a comic book?
Sure. I will, you know, just preface this by saying, like, writing for every medium is different. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference between writing for feature film versus writing for television versus writing for animation. And I'm fortunate that I've been able to adapt what I do to the different things. And I think part of that also goes back to my background and working as an editor, mm-hmm. because for a lot of these things, it's about rhythm. It's about pacing. It's about how to present information in a way that fits that particular medium in terms of how it conveys information. And all of that comes back to sort of understanding the rhythm and pacing of things. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, coming from film, I think one of the things that you learn is collaboration, because no film is made in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. There are very few films that are made where you have the auteur who's like, this is how it is. You know, the Quentin Tarantinos who turn in their script saying you can't alter a word are Quentin Tarantino and maybe, like, I don't know, Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, it's a short list.
You know, like I've been through the studio development system where they're like, we love this idea, you know, about these two young guys. We can't cast that, though. Can you make these two young guys in their 20s, one guy in their 30s, instead of being set in New York, can you make it a road trip and go across the country? I'm like, I can.
I guess.
But, like, you know, and just learning to sort of work with people under the confines of what they're trying to figure out, mm-hmm. You know, like what they can do. So if you come into film with, especially as a writer, if you're feature film, with the attitude of like, what I have written is the word, you're not going to work in feature film for very long. Yeah. And the same thing in TV, which again is a collaborative medium. There are very few people who can Aaron Sorkin things where they write all, you know, all the episodes of The West Wing by themselves, right? You know, in traditional TV writer's room, you have a showrunner who's there to really write the pilot and write one or two episodes of the year. And then he works with a team, or she works with a team of anywhere from 10 to 20 writers. And they break down the episodes and they have discussions about how everything should function. And then writers go off and write it. And then the showrunner will help put it together. But it's a big collaborative approach to telling a story. And so I think, like, that for comics is so important, mm-hmm. especially if you're a new writer. If you're coming to comics, and I try to tell this also to my friends from film and television, please don't come in thinking because you wrote this script, you are the creator of this, right? You have to, you know, their script is but a blueprint, a template for something that you're going to build. Mm-hmm. And you're going to build that with some artist. And so it's a collaboration. And the minute it stops being a collaboration, you're not going to create something great. Because I don't care how good of a writer you are or how good of a visual sense you have. If you start dictating and stop collaborating, you're going to lose the essence of what makes comics its own medium. And so like that's a really important transition for any writer coming in to know you need to collaborate, you need to trust your artist, you need to know that you're working together, that your artist is going to have strengths and weaknesses just like you do as a writer. And hopefully you're finding someone who can balance that out, and together you can make something that's greater than the sum of the parts. And so like, I think that's a really important mind space that you need to be in as a creator when you come to comics. In terms of like other things that you really need to understand is you need to sort of dive into the medium and see what makes comics unique. And there are a couple of things, I mean, just off, you know, the top of my head, like page turns. Knowing how, and some of this is changing a little bit in terms of how people consume things with digital media. But like, if you go back to the physical, like there are actual physical things that can alter your perception of how you are ingesting, you know, the story. And so taking advantage of those tools that are inherent to that medium is so important. You have to understand pacing. You have to understand how panels can dictate tempo and rhythm. Because that's not something that you have in other writing, right? You know, you have to choosing what dialogue lands on what beat. And this is where, for me, it goes back to that film editing background where you're thinking about when am I cutting? When am I not cutting? Right. And how many actions you can have happen in one panel and make it readable. What do you need to do to speed things up, to slow things down? So like all of that expansion of time, compression of time. And if you go and you like, Will Eisner, you know, one of the masters, has this great, I mean, that's the other thing. Like I in the 80s, someone who was like a friend of the family gave me a stack of old Spirits magazines from the 70s. And if you haven't read the Spirit, it's this amazing strip that was started in the 40s, you know, and then
classic.
Yeah. And Will Eisner was, you know, light years ahead of so many of his contemporaries. And he wrote some of the first graphic novels, or the first, you know, formal graphic novels that were called graphic novels. And he helped codify a lot of the language of visual storytelling and parse it out so other people could understand it. I mean, for me, Eisner in many ways is like Orson Welles. You know, you can go back and you look at Citizen Kane, and some of it, yes, feels dated. But you also, if you take a step back and you look at those techniques, there's so many of them that are still being used today in terms of storytelling and traditions and light and shadows. And like, and Will Eisner was doing that stuff in the 40s. And in the 70s, he had this book called Sequential Storytelling, where he talks about how to show time in a static medium, you know, and that's such that's an super interesting concept. And like, he's breaking it down and he's like, here are some, like even little tricks, like having a candle burning in the background so you can track time by how much the candle has melted, you know, like from panel to panel, you know how much time has passed, things like that, water dripping. Like there are like, he's like, think of ways that, you know, if you need it, that you can show how much time has passed, because that is something that's harder to show in comics, you know, where you can expand and compress the moment, but there are ways like tricks and guides, but it's also just something to think about and be conscious of. And then a lot of that is our tricks for artists, but as a writer, you need to be cognizant of that as well. How are you expressing time in a static medium?
Wow. That is so, so interesting. I love hearing about the kind of, you know, nitty gritty details and differences that go into, you know, like you were saying, making comics versus TV and movies. We had a couple horror writers on recently for Spooky Season. And something I found interesting, which I think, you know, you touch on as well, is how, you know, in a horror movie, a big thing is the score, like the music to add the jump scares and stuff. But when you're writing a horror comic, you obviously don't have that. So just hearing, like I said, the different toolboxes that you have to work with in different mediums, I think is just so fascinating. I could sit here and talk to you about that all day. But I got to ask you really, really quickly, because I mean, this could be a whole other episode worth of conversation. Sure. But with your experience in film, animation, TV, and then obviously in comics, I'm very curious with what is your kind of thoughts on, you know, we're living in the age of the comic book movie. And you even touched on this a little bit in your experience when in 2010, I think you said there was like off the heels of Iron Man, everyone wants these huge IPs. So I'm just curious again, very quickly, again, this could be a whole topic of discussion for another episode. But what are your thoughts of the kind of age of comic book movies that we live in and some of the benefits and maybe drawbacks of that?
Well, first of all, I mean, I need to sort of, again, preface this with what I grew up with, was the, you know, the age of the death of the comic book movie, right? Like we had, like when I was really little, we had Superman, and that Christopher Reeve Superman, which was amazing.
Yeah.
And then there was, by like the third, like that their wheels had fallen off that franchise, and everything else for a long time was terrible. Marvel was doing these atrocious movies that went direct to video, including the Fantastic Four.
I would say you didn't like that Fantastic Four, man. Come on.
I got to see that Fantastic Four when Sergio Aragonés, you know, the guy who does Gru and a bunch of things, brought it in. And when I was interning at Marvel, into the bullpen, and I watched it with him and some other people, and they were doing like a Mystery Science Theater 3000 of it, because at that time it was bootleg. This was before the internet, and there was no way to see that film. You know, like, and so like Marvel had no good, did not have a good film until probably, you know, 2000 with X, or, you know, I guess Amazing, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man kind of changed some things, right? But like Marvel didn't have a good superhero film until the mid to late 90s. And so I grew up with horrible Marvel films and an occasional Batman film that was good until they decided that superheroes weren't working anymore and would scuttle that for a while. Right. So for me, this is a magical era where all the content is just out there, and, you know, and you can argue whether, oh, this Marvel movie is good, this one's not as good, but you're getting like 8 Marvel movies a year. You have TV shows, you have high budget productions of all of these things. DC is killing it with their animation. You know, like some of their TV shows are pretty good. Their movies, like, you know, like debatable whether you like them or not. Some people love them, some people don't, but we are in a sea of content. And that's, you know, that's wonderful, especially for a Big Two fan. There are some, you know, some other things that are being created. On the comic book side, it's not been quite as good. And I'll say this, you know, sort of stepping back, you know, looking at what's happening right now to some of the comic book shops, and, you know, the comic book shops in general are a business model that's based upon revenue generated by the Big Two. You know, that's how they arose. The ones that have been around forever, almost all of their customers are based on Wednesday Warriors, right? You know, and depending on the store, their non-Marvel or DC sales might be anywhere from 5% to, at a big indie store, maybe 25%. But for most of it, like, the revenue is Marvel and DC. And what this explosion of film has done is it's created more places for people to see that content. And I think if you are a young person right now, and by that I mean you're someone in elementary school or middle school, the multimedia version is so exciting and so well done. There's less incentive to go to the comic book shops to get these stories. Whereas when I was growing up, those were the only places you could find those stories. And so I think that is impacting the comic book industry, combined with the fact that the success of these movies set off a speculator boom in the investment companies, where they're like, oh my goodness, there's so much money to be made in comics. Look at the Avengers that just made like $8 billion or whatever it is. We need to find the next one. And so all of these investment companies tried to find some comic book people to start up new publishers. And they dumped in a lot of investment money into creating these new publishers. So like 2014 through 2010, we had an explosion of the small publisher. And all this new indie content came in and started flooding the shops, which is great because there were jobs for creators and there were opportunities for artists and things like that. However, you know, normally in a market expands based on what fans, you know, what the market will bear, right? You know, you don't put out 8 different types of apples if there aren't people coming in who love apples and who are going to pick up all 8 types of apples, because the apple salesman would go out of business, right? Unfortunately, in comics, you had all these publishers coming in who were chasing that golden lottery ticket, like they seem with the Avengers, and their revenue is not tied to how well their books were doing in the stands, right? Mm-hmm. Their revenue was based on the investment money that they got from these investors to create an Avengers. So over the last like 5 years in particular, the market has become flooded with way too much content because there was all this money pumped in to find the next Avengers. And then shortly, you know, as the pandemic was winding down and interest rates were going up, these companies were finding that they weren't getting, that wasn't happening, mm-hmm. right? And then they're looking for their investment back. And so what we've found right now is like now these companies are having that spigot turned off, and there's a lot of smaller publishers that are in trouble because of this. And the same thing is true for a lot of comic book shops who are trying, because they figured, oh, there must be a market for all these books. So they were buying them all, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, and not able to return them. So a lot of shops have overexpanded. And so what we are seeing right now, and sadly, it's going to happen probably over the next year to 2 years, is a contraction of the marketplace to the size that it's actually sustainable. And that's going to mean some publishers are going to go away. It means some shops are going to go away. Does not mean comics are going to go away. Comics are constantly evolving. You know, mm-hmm. and what kind of context comics people are interested in are constantly evolving. But so you know, all of this goes like, I love all the media, but if you look downstream to see what it's done to comics, you know, rather than, you know, buttressing and lifting up comics and being like, oh, the movies are doing well, the comics must be doing well, I think it's just taken some of the wind out of the sails. It's pushed a lot of investors into comics who shouldn't have been there. And mm-hmm. and so overall, the market has been hurt by it. The comic shops and the smaller publishers, and you know, even like Marvel and DC as publishing companies have been hurt a little bit. That doesn't matter because for them, they're owned by larger conglomerates that are making money hand over fist through their movies and other things. So they're fine. They're, you know, Marvel and DC, no matter what you hear, are going to be 100% fine.
Yeah,
you know, they make more money than God.
Yeah, and that's kind of the reason I wanted to ask you about it, because I mean, this has been going on, I would probably since Iron Man, the first Iron Man, but I feel like especially right now, the past couple weeks with the Marvels coming out, the hit pieces have been on an all-time high of like, oh, Marvel is dead, and is Marvel dying and stuff. So again, I just thought you would have a very interesting perspective given your, you know, professional history.
Yeah. Like, you have to look at all the channels of revenue these companies are being mm-hmm. bringing in. And Marvel is part of Disney, and Disney has Disney Plus, and so there's that revenue subscription, and there's the merchandising, and there's the toys, and like, it, like at the end of the day, a multi-billion-dollar company, some years will make less billions, and some years will make more billions. They're still making billions. Yeah. So, like, you know, and we are in a time of hot takes and outrage mm-hmm. and, you know, polarization of politics and tribalism, and everyone wants to kind of jump on something. And, you know, there was an article that was recently on ICV, which a comic book shop retailer was talking about how it's diversity in comics that's causing sales to fall. And no, it's not. It's also like, if you're a comic shop and you only sell Marvel and DC, I think you're being short-sighted, because down the road, things are changing. You know, manga is becoming a bigger part of things. And if you want to attract the next generation of readers, it's not going to be Marvel and DC. That's probably going to be, you know, being 80 to 90% of your shop's revenue 20 years from now, if you still have a shop, right?
Yeah.
Like I could see that 80 to 90% being 50 to 60%. As, you know, all the other forms of comics rise up to take the place, and again, form that special community that was always in a comic book shop when I was growing up, where it mm-hmm. felt special. You know, this is the place where you go to get this kind of content that only you know about, that mm-hmm. you can only find here. And, you know, if these other stories can be found everywhere, it's the stories that can't be found everywhere that, you know, give these shops intrinsic value, because they are the place you can find this stuff.
100%. And I mean, we are huge proponents over here for our local comic shops. And I think you make a really good point as well that I never really considered. I guess I've always been under the kind of assumption of, like you touched on, you know, the movies are so big, and, you know, it makes everything so big that I always thought that that would push people to the stores because they're like, oh, like I really enjoyed Guardians. Like I want more of that. So like, let me go find more. But I think you make a very great point in the sense of, you know, since the movies are so good, which I know is subjective, but, you know, at least you, I think we can all agree they're made very well and they're such a big spectacle that I think you, again, make a great point that a lot of younger kids these days probably aren't as, you know, pressed to go and find a comic book or read about it because there is just so much content. Like, especially right now, you could spend months just going through all of the Marvel stuff before you even touched a comic book. And, you know, I'm still relatively a young man, but when I was a kid, it was the same way. Like, if I wanted more Spider-Man stuff, I had to go to the comic shop. If I wanted more Batman, I had to go read about it. And I think that is a dying kind of art form right now.
Well, and I think like if you just to your point, you know, like if you wanted more Spider-Man right now, right? You have so many of Everywhere. The big Spider-Man movies, right? Like, mm-hmm. like you can do like the classic ones, you can do the recent ones, but also if you go to Disney Plus, how many different Spider-Man cartoons are on there?
Yeah.
Right?
100%, like, so
if you want,
yeah.
like if you come off the movie and you want more Spider-Man cartoons, you have like 100 different episodes of half hour cartoons. And you can even go back to like the cartoon I watched when I was younger, which was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends.
I would say Amazing like, Friends, yeah.
Yeah, like all those seasons are on there and they're still fun.
Yeah,
and
then you can 100%. Sort of get
into
it.
So like, I just see like the movies pushing people into that.
Yeah.
You know, like you watch Love Guardians of the Galaxy. Well, there's the Groot cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch that, right? You know, and, or yeah. you can watch some of the other. So like, there's so much multimedia content. The animated versions, the TV shows, the movies that you can get for free, especially if your parents have a subscription, versus you having to spend money and you have to go somewhere, because I think kids don't go places as much anymore. Also, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. like, so like, you know, and I can find my community online. I don't need to mm-hmm. go find a group of strangers in a shop.
That's another, common interest. You know, really great point. Yeah. Another really great point I didn't consider.
So, for all those reasons, particularly when it comes to big two content, I think the availability of so much. And look, if you watched Iron Man and you love that, I mean, the comics can be well written, but you know, it's not. You know, now I'm blanking on the actor, Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
It is hard to replicate Robert Downey Jr. on a page. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a singular force unto himself. Even in those movies, sometimes he stands out, right?
Yeah.
You know, like there's a couple of those actors who they are just so charismatic. You want to watch them no matter what. And so when you're used to that, and like when you're used to looking at the sun, looking at a flashlight doesn't have the same kind of feel. And I'm not saying that the movies are better. Because I get what you're throwing down for sure. Yeah. So it just, I think especially for kids who are used to a certain level of something, sometimes going to the comic, and it's also a transition of how you consume and everything. Yeah. It just becomes harder and harder, I think, for those stories to measure up the better the multimedia versions become.
100%. And I think Tony Stark is probably the best example of that, because I mean, Robert Downey, he just took that character to a whole different stratosphere. I'd say all the time, and this is how I can tell, like, people were not reading comics before, you know, the MCU and all this stuff, because I tell people all the time, Iron Man was not an A-lister before the MCU. Like, I would even go as far as like D-list character, which I, you know, don't get me wrong, he has his fans. I was a fan of Iron Man, but the character, Tony Stark as a character in the comics, is much, much different pre-2008 than it is afterwards. Yes. So I think, like you said, Tony Stark's probably the best example of that. And I agree, it is kind of hard, especially, you know, we're comic nerds, so we know this stuff. But if I never read an Iron Man comic, and then I go and read some of, you know, the Stan and Jack stuff, it's going to be way, way different.
Right. And like the other thing to remember is the entire MCU was built on the characters they still had the rights to.
Yeah.
Because they had licensed off all their popular characters, right? Like for me, when I was growing up, if you looked at the charts, every single, like the charts were dominated by X-Men, mm-hmm. Spider-Man, Batman and whatever Wolverine was crossing over into.
Yeah.
Right? Like you had to go to like to the 50th ranked comic usually to find an Avenger.
Or Captain America or Iron Man. Yeah, like, yeah.
Exactly.
But I mean, we could do a whole episode just on this topic because we could go on. And I think your insights on this are just super, super interesting. And you have such amazing points. But let's start talking about some of your work. We're talking about all these comics and all the, superheroes and all this stuff. Let's talk about your work. So let's start off with White Ash. So again, I'm a super big fan of this world that you've created here. And being a big fantasy nerd that I am, I'm curious, I got to ask, what was kind of the spark that start? Because obviously you're working with a huge world here with mythology and creatures and all this kind of stuff. So what was the kind of original spark for this idea? And what were some of your, I guess, fantasy influences on this work? Like, just for an example, I'm sure that you're a fantasy nerd as well. Like Tolkien, for example, very much into the world building aspect and, creating this whole mythology. But then on the other hand, you have someone like George R. R. Martin, who also creates a great world in mythology, but more focused on characters and the characters' relationships. So again, how would you say that the spark of Galarian came from and what kind of influences did you draw from?
Sure. I should step back because they're maybe people who have watched the show that don't know White Ash, that don't know Galarian. Like the quick log line on White Ash is it's, I like to say, Romeo and Juliet meets Lord of the Rings in rural Pennsylvania. So it's modern day fantasy set in coal mining country. Mm-hmm. And then Galarian is the origin story of the world's most dangerous elf, told through the eyes of a young woman in 1970s New York who's having visions of being this elf warrior from 3,000 years ago. And over the course of that miniseries, those two stories are going to come together. You're going to find out how those two women are connected. It's also going to pay off a piece of the past of White Ash. It's all one big connected universe. And Galarian is a little bit more beyond being the origin story of Galarian. I'm using the Galarian character and some of her history to show the flashbacks of basically how things came to be in White Ash. White Ash is the story going forward. Galarian is all the prequel books that sort of set up the universe and the world and push things forward. Now, specifically to your question, I was a big Tolkien fan. I was also a big Terry Brooks fan. I love the Shannara series. But what I really loved later on as I got a little bit older was his Magic Kingdom of Landover series. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you ever read that, but it's this great series that's set modern day in New York and about this really rich guy who has everything, who finds an article in some like fancy magazine for people who have everything about a magic kingdom for sale. And so he buys it and like he goes to the woods of West Virginia, I think it is, and crosses over to a portal and like he thinks it's going to be a scam the entire time, but he actually has bought a magic kingdom, but he's also bought all the problems that go along with being the owner of this magic kingdom. And it's this amazing story. And like, for me, that was the first taste of something that I like to call fantasy creep or urban fantasy, or just ways of grounding readers in things they understand and can relate to before they go into that big magical world. Narnia does that. To an extent, Harry Potter did that. For me, I think looking at fantasy and the kind of writing that I want to do, while I have big universes, I never want to try to out Tolkien.
Yeah.
So I don't look at it, I'm going to build this gigantic fantasy universe and lose people in like 100 different lands and 100 different kingdoms and realms and warring tribes and this and that. I want to ground it in stories that people can relate to and understand. At the core of it, and for those people who read White Ash, you'll see it's kind of a second generation immigrant story.
Mm-hmm.
It's about people trying to choose the path that they are going to have going forward. Do they follow in the footsteps of their parents and their cultural experiences, or do they forge their own thing? How do those experiences influence who they are going forward and the choices that we make? Because I think, when you're 20, and that's kind of roughly around the time when the main character, Alec, is, I think a lot of us go through this period where we think we are just us, right? And like that path to adulthood, we have to finally either accept or reject the trappings of, you know, who our parents were. Mm-hmm. As we get to understand our, because especially when you get away, you get some perspective on like, oh my God, not everyone does things this way, or this was just the craziness of my house. Mm-hmm. But maybe I love that craziness. Maybe like I want to keep some of that for my kids or whatever. And so you have to forge your own identity. So like I love that as a time period in life, you know, in the late teens, early 20s, when you formulate who you're going to be going forward. So, you know, like that's the kind of story that is always interesting to me. But specifically to the spark, you know, this will go back to Tolkien and also to Peter Jackson, in that I was watching, you know, I love the Lord of the Ring movies, mm-hmm. the Hobbit movies. I think maybe there's too much stuff going on. You know, maybe you overexpanded it a little bit, you know,
yeah.
Especially as a filmmaker, I think you could cut down 3 movies to 2 movies.
I'd say that's another conversation story that we can have, that we can do a whole nother episode on.
Right. But like that's from a filmmaking hat, you know, like from a fan hat. Sometimes it's better to have all kinds of things. But if you want to create a movie in a world that's accessible, there's pace, there's all kinds of things. And I don't think those movies, the Hobbit trilogy, hit those marks as well as, say, Lord of the Rings did. And it was also expanding one book into 3 movies versus taking 3 movies for 3 books. So like,
absolutely,
you know,
insanity. Like I said, that could be a whole nother topic of conversation.
That could be a studio edict, you know, like we need another trilogy, do the hot, you know, like, and so that may
I think
the
that's what it was
working on, but all of that regardless, because I think the pace of those movies was not for me as a viewer, did I lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, am I back?
Yeah.
Everything froze for a second.
Oh, you glitched for a quick second, but yeah, you're good now.
Yeah. Okay. So I was going to say, like, for me, that the pace of those movies was not put together in a way that was an immersive experience. Mm-hmm. So often during points in those movies, I started thinking about things. And there was one dynamic that they introduced in this film, in the Hobbit movies, that was not really native to the book. And I think it was probably trying to get a little more gender diversity, because as much as I love the Lord of the Rings, you know, movies and the Hobbit, you know, it's an all male story. And mm-hmm. when I was trying to get my daughter to read it, she's like, where are the girls?
True. Yeah.
Which is a good question when you're like 10 or 11.
Very
like,
valid.
I want to see me in this story and I don't see me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like there was a female elf character that they put into, you know, into the Hobbit stories that I don't
Wasn't
have any.
Wasn't that, what's her face from Ant-Man, right?
Yes.
Lily?
Angeline Lily. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I remember.
And so, like, and so they created this elf dwarf romance that was kind of shoehorned in. And that was what kind of just had me noodling as I was watching this movie and thinking about, you know, like that is sort of an interesting, like Romeo Juliet kind of vibe, but it's so underdeveloped and it's not really intrinsic to the story. I bet there's a better story to be told with that. And so like that was kind of the launching point for everything that I did, is like as I'm watching this other movie, I'm thinking about another story. You know, just like it's a spark, and you take a spark and then you start contextualizing it with some of the things that you want to tell and the kind of stories that you want to showcase and what you like to write. Because like my background, as I said earlier, was like I wanted originally to write romantic comedy, so I love character pieces, but I also love doing action pieces. So like this was a starting point where I could do a lot of different things, and especially setting that modern day, I started thinking, have I seen this before? I must have seen this kind of dynamic before in modern day, and I couldn't think of it. And so I said, if I can't think of it and it feels like it's something that there should be, I'm going to do that myself. And so that was it. And here we are.
Hell yeah, man. I love that so much. And I love the fact that like this whole thing came from something you didn't like. Like you saw it's like, but I think that kind of goes to the kind of creative process and the kind of the mind of creatives and writers and stuff, is that you saw this relationship and was like, I don't really like how they did this, but I see the seed there. Like you were able to see the seed of success in that story. And you took that and made it into your own thing and expanded on, like I said, the good idea that was in there, but just didn't get fleshed out. So I think that's super cool. And again, just kind of a testament to, you know, your creativity.
Well, just for, again, for the viewers, White Ash really has nothing to do with The Hobbit at all.
It's a completely relationship story.
But there is a relationship at the core of White Ash that was influenced by this. I think like those things are because I don't want to read this book. It's a Hobbit ripoff. Has nothing to do.
White Ash, Hobbit sequel.
yes.
But I'm also curious too, again, with creating this whole world and this, you know, fantasy and the mythology and all that you're working with, I'm curious too what the kind of research process is for a story like this, because obviously you're take, like we just talked about with, you know, the Hobbit comparison, you're taking twists on existing things, and obviously, again, being the Thor guy, we got, you know, Sifalheim and elves and light elves and all this stuff. So again, I'm curious, what does the research look like for a project like this? Obviously, I'm sure you're looking at Norse mythology, you're looking at other, you know, sort of fantasy stories. So again, how does that, like, I don't know, it just seems like such a daunting task. I wouldn't even know where to start, right?
Well, I think, so going again to the, you know, you can get lost in world building, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you have to know what your true north is. And for me, it's the relationship of these characters in White Ash. It's about, you know, finding your identity, forging your identity. And then, like, you know, a more practical application is like, how do we get home? Right. Mm-hmm. You know, like, which if you read White Ash, that makes a little bit more sense. It's like, how do we return to where we came from or not? And so like everything is sort of based off of those compass points. So if you know those things, you know your themes. In terms of the research, for sure, I have a whole tab on, you know, like a drop-down menu of different references. Like here's my, here's like one, like Elvish dictionary. Here's another Elvish dictionary. and I'll pull some pieces from those things. Sometimes I will combine them because like at the end of the day, you don't want to be pulling someone's things, you know, their work specifically, right?
You want
to get inspired by other things. I mean, I have lots of different Norse mythology breakdowns, and then, you know, you'll watch some YouTube videos, and then you take what is the core, which is the mythos that you know, and then you extrapolate on it and you build something on it that's hopefully unique. It's your take on the mythos, but you're using the foundation that is seeped in, you know, lore as old as time, right? And so for things like that, like when it comes to the mythology of the piece, I really do, you know, I have things open. You know, I have characters that, like in our world, you know, there are some characters who live for very long periods. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a character that was born in, you know, roughly like 1918. So their speech pattern is predicated upon them growing up in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. And so I have a drop down of slang from those different time periods, mm-hmm. because, you know, like I want to pepper that character's speech pattern with some of those, you know, some of those cadences.
Yeah.
So I do take a lot of time thinking about those things. The Glarion story, which is set in the 1970s, it's set in 1971 specifically for a reason. You know, like there's some hints about some events that are going on right now in 1971. But like, that's going to be, germane to the story that's being told there, like why it's that year. Mm-hmm. So I do base that in real time, real events. I do a little bit of historical research because, you know, these are real places I want. I love, historical fiction that builds upon things and gives you the story behind the story, mm-hmm. and things like that. So, you know, to give a little bit more weight to what's happening. And again, I always want this to feel like it's something that could be happening, you know, in that strange town that was like one traffic light down the road from you, right?
Yeah.
But you always kind of drove through a little quickly. You know, like my other like little touchstone is I like to think of, you know, this in the vibe of Twin Peaks.
Okay.
You know, Twin Peaks meets Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like it just has like that town that's just sort of set away from time a little bit. And honestly, if you go into little coal mining towns or little industrial towns, there is this weird ageless sort of set apartness that those towns have, because it's an industry that's been around for so long, and so much of the infrastructure that has grown up is supporting something that was really relevant 50 years ago. So,
Yeah, and I think you 100% achieve that in this series, in the sense of, you know, taking these myths that have been around, you know, for hundreds of years, but adding your own spin to it and making it interesting and, you know, feel like it's a new world. Again, being the Thor guy, you know, I'm very well versed in, you know, the Norse mythology and stuff. And again, I thought, you know, your take on the elves and the trolls and all that, the giants, it felt new and fresh and exciting. So I think you 100% achieved that in your work. And I gotta ask too about Galarian specifically, and sure. You touched on this very quickly, but I want to kind of dive a little deeper into it. Something that I really love about the book is in the way that you structure it, and you've referred to this as kind of like Lost flashbacks, like how the show Lost would do their flashbacks. So I'm curious, why did you decide to go with this kind of flashback structure in order to tell this story? I'm sure that it's something we'll find out in issue 3. But again, like deciding to introduce this young woman character in New York and having her kind of experience Galarian's life through these visions instead of just being Galarian doing her thing, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. One, I was trying to not replicate, but understand what people love about White Ash, mm-hmm. right? When I'm doing a spinoff series. And one of the things that there's a lot of people who read White Ash who are not high fantasy fans, but like the fantasy world that I've built because it feels tangible, it feels real. So I wanted a way when I was telling Galarian, like there was one brief, you know, quick outline I jotted out that was just Galarian's story. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this doesn't feel like it's part of the White Ash universe. This, you know, like that's fine for these short stories. And I've told a couple of, I have one, and if you can get it through this Kickstarter, this hardcover of just 8 Galarian short stories. Galarian also, just for your viewers, is a little bit like, I like to say White Ash is a PG-13 book, mm-hmm. PG-13 universe that these R-rated characters come to visit. Galarian's one of those R-rated characters, so her universe is a little bit more in that Game of Thrones vein. Mm-hmm. But when I was telling her origin story, it just seemed more interesting if I tried to tether it to some kind of reality that made sense. And honestly, I was thinking also long term, and this Rachel character will have some, you know, ramifications down the road in White Ash in terms of what's going on. So there is definitely a connection between the woman who's having the visions in the 1970s and Galarian the Elf Warrior 3,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it was a way, in a sense, to continue Galarian's story and move it into the modern age. So like there's a lot going on there. And, you know, the third issue, there's a lot more overlap between the two women, almost mm-hmm. like if you have, you know, like that veil between worlds and it's slowly being pierced, the yeah. realities are shifting a little bit. So there's going to be some of that going in this next issue. And there's a more of a feeling of like those stories coming together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, especially if you like that, I think you'll really enjoy it in this third book. You know, one of the things I like to do in these Kickstarter stories is I also have the luxury of space, mm-hmm. right? So I don't have to be knocking something out in 22-page increments or 20-page increments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like these are bigger stories, so I can take the time to weave the tapestry together of two, you know, seemingly unconnected tales and, you know, and parallel themes or storylines going back and forth between the two of them. That, you know, this most recent one is 44 pages. So it's basically two 22 pages
yeah.
together. So you really have the room to tell two different stories.
And I love that too. I really love the decision to, you know, tell the story in this way, flashing between the two different characters. I love stuff like that. So to hear that the third issue deals with that a little bit more, makes me super excited. But so let's talk about the Kickstarter really, you know, for a little bit,
for
like
sure.
You were just talking about. So what we've been talking about for most of this interview are White Ash and then issues 1 and 2 of Glarion. So the Kickstarter is going to be for issue 3, which again, even just hearing you talk about it right now, I'm super excited to get into and see this mystery that you're setting up again with Glarion and this Rachel character. So the Kickstarter ends on, let's see,
the 15th of November.
15th of November?
15th of November. Yeah.
So 15th of November, it ends currently at 1,242 backers. And again, I can't wait for this third issue. Everyone that's listening and watching this out here, please go and back this. It is, again, issues 1 and 2 were so great. This is going to be a 4-issue series, you said, right?
Five issues. So yeah, and like we always have catch up tiers for everything. There's a White mm-hmm. Ash Universe collection where you can get all of the White Ash and Glarion. You can get our other books, and I think that's something that's magical about Kickstarter. You know, if you've missed out on something, it's easy to catch up.
Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Where if you see just issue 3 on the stands, especially if it's an indie comic, sometimes tracking down 1 or 2 are really hard.
Damn near impossible sometimes.
Right, and so like, you can always do that. So we have like issues 1, 2, and 3 of Glarion. We have a hardcover that has 8 short Glarion stories that will also tell a little bit of an arc in there.
Mm-hmm.
Some, I would say that there's definitely some relation between that little collection and anthology of stories and what's going on in the miniseries. They're all related. Everything I do is part of one large map.
Mm-hmm.
So even when things feel like they are unconnected, they eventually will pay off. Yeah, and so this will be a 5-issue miniseries. We have a couple other Glarion things in the works as well, because people love Glarion,
mm-hmm.
We're going to see. In addition to this series, there's going to be a 1-shot coming out some point next year, which will be a Glarion and Thane kind of love story,
mm-hmm.
1-shot adventure that also tells some more of that backstory. We have more White Ash coming out early next year. We have it's a very full slate.
Business is booming, man. Business is booming. I love it. And I think too, something I really love about this Kickstarter in particular is I love all the different reward options that you have on here. You have so many different ones. I mean, really for any kind of price range that, you know, that you can fit into your budget, you have something for it. And I think that just goes to show like how much you, one, believe in the story and two, care about your backers as well. And I think just super important.
100%. Like, I mean, we've been doing this long enough where I'm looking to build readers. So we try to have tiers that are somewhat cheap for people to catch up compared to say some other things you might find on Kickstarter. And then especially if you're following me on Kickstarter, the first 2 days when we launch a campaign, we have a lot of cheap discount catch-up tiers, mm-hmm. and you know, other deals, and then we have the higher end things as well. I don't know exactly when this is going to air, but if it's going to air,
it'll be soon, before the Kickstarter ends for sure.
I was just going to say we're also going to be dropping, and I'll tell this in the show because I'll be posting this update later today, we're going to be doing 3 days of sketch cover drops. The White Ash artist, Connor Hughes, who is my mm-hmm. partner, and he's amazing, who's been doing a bunch of Walking Dead covers recently, did a Void Rival cover, and is going to be doing maybe some more stuff for Skybound. So like he's going to be coming out to join me at LA Comic Con from December, I think it's 1st through 3rd or 2nd through 4th.
The 1st through the 3rd.
So he'll be there all 3 days. And he's going to be doing 2 sketch covers each day that will be LACC on Glarion #1 blanks. And we only printed up 50 of those. So over the next couple of days, each day we will drop, we'll have the 2 Friday ones, the 2 Saturday ones, and the 2 Sunday ones. So, if you're a collector, and I think those will be roughly $200 a piece, which is a pretty good deal for a sketch cover.
Yeah.
Especially when they're going to be limited like that. Mm-hmm. From a book. So, so we do the higher end things too, but I also still try not to make them too high end because again, I want the people who love the world, who are collectors, to be able to afford things.
100%. And I mean, that is just so cool. Everyone, if you're in the area, make sure to head over to LA Comic Con so you can get your sketch. I mean, I think I'm going to get one, man. I'm going to make my way over there to get mine. But again, this just, I really love this Kickstarter. I love this series that you've created and the world that you're building with it. You have made a fan of me just in this little bit that we've been talking here and the, you know, little bit that I have jumped in. And again, just everyone out there, please go and back this Kickstarter. I'm going to be putting all the links to the Kickstarter and all your other work in the description. So easy for you guys to go find it and, you know, follow the links down there. But again, man, it's just such a great book. I'm really excited for it.
Well,
I'm excited
so
for this third issue, and not only the third issue, but I'm excited for issues 4, 5 and everything that's coming after. I know you've already mentioned that we have more Galarian coming. We have more White Ash stuff coming, but I'm curious, do you just have White Ash blinders on right now, or is there something else in the works in the future?
Like, well, we've got, you know, Connor's actually finishing up. We have a side series, like Grounded Sci-Fi, in the series called The Game. He's finishing up the third issue of that. Mm-hmm. And so, like, that is an ongoing series. I'm also doing the How I Slept My Way Through College and the Tales from Freshman Year series. That's a 12-issue maxi series that I'm working on. I write this book called The Adept for Immortal Comics, which is part of that universe. And going forward, in addition to, like, all of those, there are one or two things I'm considering getting into, but you also don't ever want to expand too much. Mm-hmm. Want to make sure that we're putting out the books that we're currently putting out at the quality and at a pace that I feel comfortable with. But yeah, there's a big science fiction, like Burroughs-esque, you know, sprawling tapestry science fiction story that I may sort of start telling at some point as well.
Well, fingers crossed that you get to it, man, because that sounds super cool. And then to kind of just round things off, this is just last couple, you know, fun questions, if you would, something that we like to ask all of our guests. So I'm curious too, we talked about this before, and we've talked about this with other creatives as well, and the sense of, you know, everything is research and or inspiration in some form or fashion. But when you're not specifically trying to research something or, you know, working, reading something for a project, what are you reading these days just for fun? Like, are you a Wednesday warrior these days? Are you picking up books? Like, what do you like to read for fun these days?
You know, like, honestly, so for me, I had a period, you know, where I was a huge comic book fan that lasted till about 2014, 2003. Mm-hmm. I mean, 2004, 2003. And then I took a break. So, like, there's this 10 to 11 year gap where comics were still coming out, mm-hmm. that, you know, for me, there's some catch up time. So, like, I've been going back, and what really excites me now usually are creator owned books, mm-hmm. Because I like that singular voice on things. There are plenty of things on Kickstarter I'm reading, but one of the things that I really have been enjoying is getting into Deadly Class. You know, just like I have some of those omnibuses, mm-hmm. and just the art and the oversized format, because it's something that's very different than what I do and the way that story is told. So I think it's always exciting to look at how something that's outside your scope, right? And that you can admire the craft of and be like, I would never do this, but it's really fascinating to see other artists doing those things. So for me, like something like Deadly Class, which I feel like is a true creative vision, and the art and the pacing on it, it's again unique to what Rick wanted to do and Craig, that I find really exciting. I'll pick up the next volume of Saga when that comes my way, mm-hmm. and I just click those in the trades. So yeah, I mean, like, I also don't really have that much time to read comics.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you're making so many great ones, it's hard to
I'm making
catch
things
up.
So like I'll pick up one here and there. And you know, I've got an old Black Sad novel. I'm working my way through, and there's lots of television and I have children. And so it's like, it's always balancing all of those things. And you read a little bit here. I wanted to, you know, I kind of, speaking of fantasy, you know, diving into the Wheel of Time series,
Okay.
which I had never read. My wife was a fan of. And so I'm also slowly working my way through that. So you know, it's a little bit here, a little bit there.
There's just not enough hours in the day, man. I've been working through the Game of Thrones series for like 5 months now, and I have 100 pages left on one of the books, and I'm just like, yeah, I'll get to it. I'll get to it eventually.
And you'll probably finish it before he finishes the next one.
Oh yeah, I'm not pressed. I got plenty of time. I know that for sure. But
Man.
Charlie, my man, it has been so much fun talking to you today. I am so grateful that you came and nerded out with me today. I've
Yeah,
Again,
for
just
sure.
had such a fun time talking about all your great work, nerding out about MCU and the kind of behind the scenes stuff that goes on with all this stuff. But at this moment, I want to throw it off to you really quickly. Tell the people where they can find you. Like I said, I'm going to be throwing the links to the Kickstarter in the description. But as far as your socials and all that, where can the people find you?
So I hang out on the platform formerly known as Twitter a little bit, where you can find me at Charles Stickney. Unfortunately, I didn't get Charlie Stickney, but you can find me at Charles Stickney. There's White Ash Comic on Instagram. There's a White Ash Comic on Facebook. There's actually an at White Ash Comic on that platform as well, the one with the big X on it now. You can find me at Charlie Stickney on Blue Sky if that's your preference. I'm trying to migrate a little bit over there, so hopefully the community is going to grow there as well. So those are, the major places to find me. And but check out the Kickstarter. We have a good, I think, 16 or 15 page preview, so you can see some of the beautiful art by Romina Morinelli, who is just incredible, who does Glarian, and there are colors by Finn Cram, who also does the colors for White Ash. So we try to tie those two things together. So check it out, and I hope to see you on the socials. And thank you so much for having me on.
Of course, of course. Like the man said, go read White Ash, go read Galarian. If you guys trust my opinion at all, and if you guys have been watching this show or listening to the show, you guys know I would never lie to you, and I'll be completely honest with you. And again, I really loved this book. I really love the world you've built. I love the characters, and I am just so excited to get more into it. I'm excited for issues 3, 4, 5. And everything that comes after. So again, I'll say it another time, just so I make sure that you heard me. Go and back Galarian issue 3 on Kickstarter. Do it right now. Turn this video off and go do it, actually, because it needs to be done right now. But again, Charlie, I gotta thank you so much for being here
Thank
with
you.
me today. It's been so much fun. But I think that's all we're going to have for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening and watching with us. If you guys like this video, consider leaving us a like and subscribe. But other than that, I hope that you have a fantastic rest of your day. Stay hydrated out there, and I hope all of your stacks are fat. We will see y'all next time.
I'm gonna do this all day.